Welcome to Asylum 49, a haunted attraction where the ghosts are all too real. Stick around to hear about the spirits that still reside in the old hospital, and even get in on the scares every Halloween when it's transformed into a premier haunted attraction. Hear this story and more coming up on Brilliant. I'm Alan Brill. Welcome to Brilliant, a podcast from the mind of Brill. Warning, it gets dark in here. Man, I have had some terrific guests on these last few shows, and I'm loving it. I'm, living my best life. But also, it's kind of nice to return to format this week. And I've got a great episode for you. And we're going to kick it off with a pair of bizarre botanical stories from the Weird Case Files. This is called Johnny Weed Seed, and it was in the San Francisco Chronicle, June 2nd, 1987. In Golden Gate Park in San Francisco, a mysterious man dubbed Johnny Weedseed has been planting South African capeweed in the park's carefully planned and manicured grounds. South African capeweed has been called a gardener's worst nightmare. This is a ground cover plant which spreads over an area, strangling any other plant that gets in its path. Jim Rogers, assistant superintendent at the park, says, "The only thing that really controls it is concrete. No matter what you do, it just takes over." They did manage to catch him long enough to learn it was a German man named Klaus, but the wily German escaped. Rogers said he has weed cuttings from his knapsack and meticulously gives them a new home in the park. South African capeweed is highly resistant to herbicides, so the only way the park staff was able to cope with the invasion was to dig up large pots of grass and replant it. Klaus had managed to plant this invasive weed in nearly every corner of the park. Rogers said, "I'm not sure if he doesn't know the trouble he's causing, or he knows it very well." What a jerk. They've got this beautiful, carefully, meticulously planned, manicured park, and he's just planting his weeds all over it. Well, dude, that's not cool, but it is kind of funny. And in our second Weird Files case, we have Carnation Carnage. And this is a strange one, which is, why it's on the show. This is the Southampton Echo, June 2nd, 1997. The Bridges florist in Bedford Place in Southampton, England, had a bizarre problem. 1,000 carnation blooms in their shop had been plucked, leaving only empty stalks. The florist, Margaret Bagley, after the first raid, had locks changed. She added extra bolts and installed a super secure padlock, whatever that means. It's, I guess, a really good padlock. But even with these extra precautions, the raids continued. So then she sprinkled talcum powder on the floor, and she even tied a thread across the door. And after the next raid, there were no footprints, and the thread remained intact. She resorted to hiding the flowers throughout the store, but they were always found. At the beginning of this bizarre and destructive six-month period, only a few blooms were plucked every now and then, but the activity ramped up until it was happening three times a week or so. The shop was given a thorough inspection by the police, including the suspended ceiling, and they ultimately deduced that, and this is a quote, "It must be a poltergeist." That was P.C. McCullough, who was the head of the investigation. The police arrived at the conclusion that it was indeed a supernatural crime. I don't know if that was said tongue-in-cheek. I assume it was, but also, I don't have any other explanation. Poltergeist that hates carnations, I guess. I don't know. That's a weird one, and I kind of love it. Now we're going to get into some legendary stuff here, some folklore. This is from Glom's Castle. It's called One Hell of a Card Game. I did a short, tried to cover it in, less than 2 minutes. So I'm like, I should add it in the episode, but yeah, nobody watched it, so I'm going to. Legend has it that late into a Saturday night, Earl Thomas, the Lord of Glom's Castle in Scotland, was playing cards. Around 11 p.m., his servant interrupted the game to inform him of the time and remind him that playing cards on the Sabbath is forbidden. Well, the Earl, he was on a tremendous winning streak, best winning streak of his life. And he berated his servant, telling him, "I'll play cards till doomsday." The servant, you know, thus dismissed. And the card game continued. And about 11:55, the servant interrupted once again, telling the Earl that, "Hey, it's 5 till midnight, man, and, you know, playing cards on the Sabbath, that's forbidden." But still on a hot streak, the Earl again berated and dismissed the servant, but the other members of the party, they weren't willing to risk their mortal soul by playing cards on the Sabbath, so they took their leave. Furious, the Earl declared that he would play cards with the devil himself. Cue the knock on the door, enter stranger clad in black. And he walked in silently, took a seat across the table from the Earl. The Earl dealt the cards, and the game continued. They played well into the next day. The Earl, obviously, as I'm sure you guessed, his winning streak turned on him. And you know, first he lost his money, then he lost his lands, then he lost his title. The only thing he had left to gamble with was his soul. The servant, he just watched anxiously through the keyhole as the last hand was dealt. And, of course, you guessed it, the Earl lost. And there was a pit that opened up and a blinding light filled the room. And when the servant could see again, both the Earl and the stranger were gone. But the pit remained, this probably a portal to hell remained, and you know, they had no idea how to deal with that, so they just sealed off the room. Now, they say that to this day, late at night when the castle is silent and quiet, if you listen carefully, you can hear the clink of poker chips and the shuffling of cards and a man swearing silent, quietly under his breath as the Earl desperately tries to win back his soul in a card game that will last for eternity. There are many legends involving this sealed room in Glom's castle, this hidden room, and I have a feeling we'll get to them. Now we're going to pivot to the haunted attraction known as Asylum 49. Now, haunted attractions, you know, the haunted houses you walk through and the actors and the scary makeup and clothes that jump out and scare you, and then the fake haunted houses. And according to America Haunts in 2024, the U.S. industry alone brings in $300 to $500 million annually. Haunted attractions are big business. We love to be scared in a controlled environment where the thrills are staged and the monsters, although the actors are terrifying, they're just actors. And one haunted attraction just outside of Salt Lake City, Utah, well, the spirits are all too real, and they're eager to meet you. 4 years after closing down, Kim Anderson purchased the old Twell Valley Hospital with an eye into turning it into a haunt. Little did he know at the time, it was already haunted, but he would soon find out. On his very first day as owner, Kim was to encounter his first ghost ever. The owner of the still-open nursing home had tried his hand at turning it into a small haunt, and the conference room still bore the remnants of this endeavor. Long white curtains were draped over wooden beams, and this made a sort of a makeshift shave, very effective. The result is very effective, and as Kim made his way through this room, he felt the hairs on the back of his neck stand up and felt he's in the presence of someone or something unseen. Shrugging, you know, this off as just being a product of not being able to see in the maze and the all-around spooky atmosphere this creates, he, you know, walked a little faster to get out of the room as quickly as he could. And that's when he felt something touching his leg. He looked down, but there was nothing there. Well, nothing he could see anyway. He then witnessed the outside of his shorts being pulled away from his skin. He had just had the first of many encounters with the spirit in what he would soon rename Asylum 49. Now, the land on which this old hospital sets is just drenched in blood and violence. During the 19th century, what is now Tooele County was home to the Goshute Native American tribe. In 1849, members of the LDS immigration group that had arrived in 1847 established a permanent settlement there. And, of course, since they settled in on the Goshute land, they had a mutual respect for each other, and they cohabited peacefully and respected the natives' beliefs and way of life. And, you know, they respect the indigenous people that had already been there, and they all lived peacefully. No, I'm kidding. That didn't happen at all. Actually, in short order, the settlers accused the Goshute peoples of cattle rustling, and then this was just an excuse to carry out attacks on the native camps to get the land to themselves. And a lot of blood, a lot of lives on both sides were spilled. A lot of blood was spilled. A lot of lives were taken. The U.S. Bureau of Indian Affairs had to step in, and Representative Robert B. Jarvis convinced some of the nomadic bands to meet at the Deep Creek Reservation, and negotiations were going well until Jarvis up and died and the reservation was abandoned. His replacement was a man named Benjamin Davis, and he said that the indigenous peoples had lost faith in the federal government, and his recommendation was to, you know, limit more encroachment into native lands. You know, let's stay out, let them have their land. They were here. And a very reasonable and suggestion, which, so of course, it was ignored. And a descent into violence rapidly ensued. The federal troops were able to somewhat keep the peace, but at the outbreak of the American Civil War, you know, they left to go fight in the Civil War. And so the settlers, they set up lookouts and they made large walls of mud right near where Asylum 49 now stands. And, you know, lots of fighting. They just had to hold out long enough for reinforcements to arrive. And in 1862, they did arrive from California. These new guys were led by General Patrick O'Connor. And O'Connor had a zero tolerance policy towards the Goshute people and often carried out attacks on native camps at just willy-nilly, killing indiscriminately. Just a real evil guy, if you ask me. Although some probably call him a hero, but nah, I'm not buying it. And finally, a peace treaty was signed in 1863. Then Tooele Valley became a booming mining community. And with these, you know, mining boom towns, violence and disease were, they sprang up with them. Rough and tumble place. Eventually, of course, the mines were mined out and the boom busted. And stepping in to fill the void of commerce was the U.S. military. And they built several bases and also chemical weapon facilities, which, yeah, there you go. Now, this influx of servicemen and their families, and it created the need for a modern hospital in this, you know, rather remote location. So it was on this land drenched in violence and malevolence and ill intent that the Tooele Hospital was constructed. The haunt that is now Asylum 49 started life in 1959 as the Tooele Valley Hospital. And it was a hospital, so it saw its share of strong emotions and death and suffering and joy and everything that comes with a place where hospitals are, life and death happens. It closed its doors for the last time as a hospital in 2002, and the building and the spirits who resided therein, they languished, abandoned, until Kim Anderson purchased it in 2006 to begin the process of turning it into the premier haunt that it is today. And it is a premier haunt. It's something spectacular. And, you know, let's meet just a few of the fascinating spirits that dwell within the confines of Asylum 49. We're just going to touch up on a few of them here. And we're going to start with Jeremy. Now, Jeremy is the spirit of a man who is horribly burned in life, and he was a patient at the Tooele Valley Hospital. And his face resembles, like, the exaggerated character of like, a clown. It has the sweeping eyebrows and the exaggerated smiles. And in fact, Kim accidentally offended Jeremy once, comparing him to a juggalo, the insane clown posse people and their fans. And Jeremy's held a grudge. He's, psychics say, he's not quite forgiven Kim for it yet. And one thing about it, his appearance, it's always accompanied by the smell of smoke. I've heard this on quite a few spirits that are been burned and burned to death in life or have been burned. They say Jeremy, he's a bit of a pervert. He's been known to follow a member of the female staff named Misty home and peep at her while she's in the shower. And, to be honest, I know quite a few people that if they had a ghost power, they would use it on doing similar things. But you know, come on, Jeremy. Be cool, man. Sarah and Tabitha, they haunt the nursery. And they're a pair of playful spirits who delight in participating in the haunted attraction. They make themselves visible to customers at the opportune times. And my favorite part, they hide under tables and chairs and they reach out and they grab the legs of passerbys. Sarah and Tabitha, they said that they get sad and despondent after the haunt closes down. They miss the energy, they miss the chaos, they miss the fun of scaring people. And, we're talking about spirits here, but let's not forget that, you know, they were living children. And Sarah is described as a little girl with dark hair and a white dress who died of pneumonia while she was a patient there. And Tabitha wears an old-timey yellow dress and was also a patient there, although it's unknown how she passed. So, yeah, a little pair of little ghost girls running around scaring people. And one time, Kim found his actors, his employees, they were hiding out. They weren't at their posts. It was getting close to opening. And he found them huddled together in the break room, and they looked frightened. And he asked what was wrong, and they told him there was a ghost in the hallway. And he's like, well, of course there's a ghost in the hallway. It's a haunted house after all. But no, they meant a real ghost, and they were terrified. So he went out to investigate. And when he did, he came face to face with the ghost of a little girl in a long white dress with long black hair. And she was just crying her heart out. She was sobbing. And that's when he realized that not only could he see the spirit, he could hear it and was going to be able to communicate it without any, you know, special means. And so he asked her what was wrong. And she told him that it wasn't fair, that she wanted to scare people too. So he said, hey, you're scaring my living workers, but if you can, you know, stay out of their sight, then you can scare all the people you want. That's awesome. So he told her to hide under the hospital beds that are staggered throughout the room, grab people's feet as they walked by. And she just was delighted by this proposition. A big smile came to her face, and he expected her to scamper under the beds, but instead she turned into this black mist and floated under one of the beds. And now she's happy. She gets to scare people. She gets to participate. Then there's the spirit of Bonnie, who's a lady, in her late 50s who died of cancer. And you can see her pushing an IV stand. And she's seen a lot in the nursery. And if she, you know, died of cancer in the cancer ward, why is she in the nursery? Well, mediums have said it's because she likes to visit the babies that she still believes are in the nursery ward. That, and she also searches the hospital in vain looking for her husband. There's a ghost of Thomas, who I find fascinating because he died an old man, but as a spirit, he shows himself as a child. So this gives us some insight, and it certainly raises some questions. Could you pick how you look when you come back? And if so, why does Jeremy still come back as a burn victim? Why do we see, why would Bonnie choose to spend eternity pushing an IV stand? Why wouldn't everybody come back young? But that's what they say. Thomas, old man, chooses to appear as a child, but I'm guessing that's not a choice that every spirit gets. It's fascinating. Okay, this next spirit frightens me on a very personal level. The implication here I find frightening, fascinating, but a bit frightening. And we're going to talk about the ghost of Wesley. He resides in what is now labeled, of course, room 666. Wesley was an Alzheimer's patient, and, you know, in life he had good days, he had bad days, he had days when he was lucid, and, you know, days when he was not. And before this just terrible disease ravaged his mind, he was a sweet guy, a sweet temperament, but as the disease progressed, he became mean and aggressive and spiteful, and, you know, bad days were like that, and the good days he was a sweet guy. And people have had different experiences in this room. Sometimes it's a warm and open feeling when they step in there, and other times there's this dark and malevolent feeling, and the spirit that resides there can be very aggressive, very physical. On occasions it's been known to violently shove and scratch people. And this is the thing that terrifies me. Is this spirit still suffering from the disease after death? That's a horrifying thought to me. Now, the owner and one of her close friends, Kim's wife, Cammie, they were also terrorized by a large shadow entity, and they believed strongly that that entity was not Wesley. So could it just simply be that there are two spirits in the room, you know, the sweet one being Wesley, who is returned to normalcy after he passed, and then this, you know, this jerk shadow guy that's also there? Could it be that simple? Or here's the thought: could the personalities have split after death, and each personality has its own separate presence in the room? I mean, just fractals, are they remnants? It gives you a lot to think about. Certainly frightening if the disease can still affect you after you pass on. Two spirits, or the idea of the personality separating into separate entities, I also find fascinating. I think there's a lot of meat on that bone we could explore. Man, there is a very disturbing story about a haunted object, and, you know, haunted objects typically deal in disturbing stories. Well, if we're talking about them, and this one, yeah, it's pretty dark. Now, Kim, he acquired a haunted rocking horse for the attraction. Not only, you know, hey, haunted objects in the attraction is going to be good, it's going to bring the energy up, but also he thought, hey, the spirits of the children, they're going to love it, they're going to like having a toy. It had, however, the opposite effect. The children, they quit coming around. They would hide in the corners. They were despondent. And, you know, he brought in a psychic to see what was going on. And the psychic told him that the rocking horse had the spirit of an adult male attached to it. An incredibly sad adult male, full of remorse, who's always crying, always sobbing, very remorseful in death, but, you know, good, because he was an evil man while alive. He was a pedophile and a child abuser, and he used a rocking horse as bait to lure children into his abusive little clutches. And his presence was intimidating the children. She says, you know, he's sad, he's very remorseful, very sorry now, he's suffering. But yeah, good. There's a spirit of a nurse named Maria, and she guards what they believe is a spirit portal in the hospital, and she's the gatekeeper. Apparently she's a pretty stern one, and she lets some spirits enter and others she keeps out, but they think she's, you know, these are for good reasons. So go Maria. And of course, every haunted house needs a villain, and an entity known as the Guardian is Asylum 49's. Guardian is kind of a weird title for a bad guy. You think of a guardian as being a good guy, a protector, but yep, not in this case. In life, he's thought to be an administrator of the hospital who gathered secrets and knowledge and used that to crush people and climb his way to the top. A jerk in life and a jerk in death. And he's known to be very aggressive to the female guests and a bully to the other spirits. And, you know, like a bully, he picks on what he perceives to be, you know, the weaker members of the group. Yeah. Strangely enough, intimidated by, like, the big burly guys that come in. Like, I don't know why being more physically intimidating would affect the spirit, but, you know, yeah, that's his mindset. He's a little bully. Or big bully, but he's a bully. This is just a sample of the spirits people have encountered in Asylum 49. Some of the ones I found just very interesting. But it has a rich and colorful population of ghosts inhabiting it. And for a complete examination of Asylum 49 and its secrets, I highly recommend the book The Haunting of Asylum 49 by Richard Estep and Cami Anderson. It's fantastic, and there's a lot I left out while preparing this episode. So if you want to learn more about it, check it out. Oh, The Haunting of Asylum 49. There it is. Got my copy on Amazon. You know, one of the unique things about Asylum 49, super active during the haunt season, you know, the few weeks leading up to Halloween and then a little bit over. But if you go during the off season, it's pretty dormant. It's pretty quiet. The spirits there really come alive during the hours that it's operating as a haunt. And of course the theory is that the emotions of thousands of visitors just getting the pants scared off them. They seem to charge it up. They're charged by the emotion and the attention, and the spirits are able to be more active to draw off that energy. Again, as I mentioned, I sourced this from the Haunting of Asylum 49, Richard Estep, Cami Anderson. Fantastic. Check it out. And, you know, before we go, we're going to do one final little story. Again, this was a short. Try to tell it in 2 minutes. And I really liked it. I really liked the end. There's some wind issues when I did the short, so I don't know if any of the details maybe got left out, so we're going to do it again. On a May night in 1908, Andrew Stasko would have the first in a series of horrific and bizarre events that would haunt him for the rest of his life. Stasko was a fireman on the Canadian Pacific Railroad. Okay, a fireman on a steam locomotive, he didn't put out fires, he stoked them. It was the fireman's job to shovel the coal into the steam engine's firebox and keep that baby roaring down the track. This is hot, dirty work, and a man had to be strong, tough, and smart in order to do it. And even though it was just nasty, grueling work, and it kept you away from your family for long periods, being a fireman was a necessary step if a person wanted to be an engineer, and Andrew wanted to be an engineer very much. And on this night in 1908, he and his crew, which was headed by an excellent and competent engineer named Touhey, were about 2 miles south of Medicine Hat when a light suddenly appeared on the tracks in front of them, and it was growing larger by the second. There was no doubt, there was no mistake. It was the headlamp of an oncoming train. 2A gave the command for the firemen to jump off the train, but it was too late for Stasko. The collision was imminent, and he knew it, and he was just bracing for impact. And at the last possible instant, the other train, it jumped to the tracks running beside him and roared by, and Stasko could see the terrified faces of the passengers on this other train, their expressions twisted in fear and agony. And with an unearthly shriek of its horn, the second train simply vanished. Which, of course it did. It was a ghost train because there were no tracks running parallel to the ones they were on. It was a single track line. Well, this really shook this go up, and despite the ambitions of becoming an engineer, he transferred to the rail yard. He put that on hold for a few weeks while he gathered his nerves, and understandably so. But ambitious and determined, he returned to the rails. And, of course, during that few weeks, he now, coming back, he now had a new crew. And this crew was led by an engineer of excellent reputation named Jay Nicholson. And, you know, his maiden trip with Nicholson, everything was going smooth until, yep, you guessed it, two miles south of Medicine Hat. Once again, the light of the oncoming locomotive rushed towards him, bearing down on him. Once again, at the last second, it switched and ran beside him. But it's the terrible visages of the passengers on the other train that haunted Andrew, just their twisted, horrific faces. So, you know, that was it. He's done. He transferred to the rail yard permanently. He was not getting back on the rails. And it was while he was working on the rail yard, that he received the tragic news. Two trains collided head on, just horrifying collision. And, you know, of course, it happened 2 miles south of Medicine Hat. So this ghost train was a premonition, but here's the part that really bends my mind. The engineers on the two trains that collided, Kuhay and Nicholson. I hope you enjoyed our exploration of Asylum 49. And if you did, please hit that like button, subscribe, tell your friends about the pod. Say, hey, it's awesome now, and it gets better and better every week. You got to check it out. You got to jump on the brilliant podcast train. Check out the channel on YouTube. I got some shorts there, all the episodes I put out so far, which aren't a lot, but hey, you can look at the backlog and watch me progress. Guys, I've got a whopper of a special for Halloween I'm putting together for you. It's shaping up fantastic. It's going to be great. You don't want to miss it. So Halloween, click back in. I'm going to have it out early, and you can use it getting ready for trick-or-treating, hanging out. It's going to give you the good Halloween vibes. It's got the weird, and it's also going to bring the scary. Don't miss it. I'm excited about it. It's going to be fantastic. Got some big name guests and Jason Offutt. I got John LeMay. Tune in. That's all I'm saying. Guys, love you. I hope you have a fantastic week. Keep it weird out there, but be careful because it can get dark out there.